Yeah, so I want to thank organizers for inviting me to this very nice conference. And so this is what we did last year with two MIT graduate students, Paolo Glorioso and Michael Crossley. So by now, so the purpose of many bodies is the purpose of many body physics. You said you start with a microscopic description, say it's a microscopic Lagrangian, and then we want to either predict or explain the microscopic phenomena. And for equilibrium, of course, a direct computation for any interacting system, except for maybe for a handful of very special systems, this is almost always impossible. And but for equilibrium systems, now we have a very powerful, anomaly sometimes called the Ginzburg-Landau-Wilson paradigm to actually settle this question, is that you choose some kind of UV cutoff, below this energy scale or momentum scale lambda is the kind of physics, the kind of low energy physics you are interested in, and then we would write down some low energy effective field theory below this cutoff, okay? And essentially what you do is that you express your free energy in terms of appropriate low-energy degrees of freedom, which are only constrained by the symmetry. So if you know the if you know what your low-energy degrees of freedom is, of course this often requires physical insight or experimental input. But once you know that, and then you know the symmetries, and then you can just write down with these two things, then you can just write down this low-energy effective theory just from, And then you can just run your realization group, and then you go to low energies, and then you predict or explain whatever the macroscopic phenomena. And for example, universality, et cetera. Okay, so this has been working very well. And but till now, there's no such counterpart for non-equilibrium systems, because the once you go to non-equilibrium, what is the counterpart of the free energy is less clear, and there's essentially much more freedom to do different things, and And of course, there are also many theoretical approaches which developed for the for non-equilibrium problems, and I would say they always suffer two problems, at least this is my personal opinion. So they either to be too microscopic, say like if you just run the Liouville equation or solving the Boltzmann equations, and they're very powerful, but you have to track too many number of degrees of freedoms. So unless for very special systems, it's normally hard to do. And then the other spectrum, and then the theory is either too phenomenological. Say, for example, hydrodynamics, stochastic systems, and you write down a phenomenological theory directly at the macroscopic level, and then you don't have much fundamental understanding of the things. And the nice thing about the holographic duality, which has been very powerful in doing non-equilibrium physics, is that it's a first principle, because you can go from UV to the IR in a single system, in a single framework, and which you only need to track small number degrees of freedom, because the essentially just map to the classical gravity, and they only need to track the gravity degrees of freedom. But in this talk, I want to talk about another way to reduce number degrees of freedom, but still beyond the phenomenological level, okay? And so this is the effect, try to develop some kind of non-equilibrium effective field theory. And for this particular talk, and I will develop effective field theory for general dissipative fluids, okay? And essentially, we want to develop an effective field theory, say, for hydrodynamics. And again, so what we are interested in is that you start with some macroscopic description, say now in the thermal density matrix, and now we want to understand the macroscopic phenomena. Okay, and so here we choose some kind of cutoff say the mean free path, say if you have an electron system, so that would be the typical collision energy scale of your electrons, and then you try to write down effective field theory for the fluids, and then now you can again run a normalization group, and then see universality, etc. So now let's talk about the how we can develop such effective field theory. So for this purpose, let's consider, say, non-wave disturbance, say, of a system in thermal equilibrium. And then the subsequent evolution of such kind of disturbance will very much depend on whether this is a non-conserved quantity or it's a conserved quantity. So if it's a non-conserved quantity, and then this quantity essentially can relax everywhere locally. And then you expect then your typical relaxation time would be, say, the mean free time. Okay, say the mean free time, and typically, and this is our UV scale, and this is UV scale, and this is considered to be very short. But now, if you have a conserved quantities, and then of course now you have a global constraint, and then such quantity cannot relax locally; they can only relax via transport. And now, if you take the wavelength of such kind of disturbance go to infinity, and then relaxation time will also go to infinity, because it takes a long time to relax the imbalance between different locations. And so now we have seen that if you have conserved quantities, then you guarantee it to have gapless and non-lived modes, okay? Just associated with the conserved quantities. And essentially, this is the only one in the thermal equilibrium, okay, in the generic situation. So if you're not close to a phase transition, so if you don't have a Fermi surface, et cetera, and then the only gapless and non-lived modes are those associated with the conserved quantities. And then if you are interested in the low-energy physics, And then what you should do, of course, you should just write down a low-energy effective field theory for those modes. Okay, you should just write down low-energy effective theory for those modes, and that would be enough to capture all the low-energy physics. And of course, at the phenomenological level, such a description is already known. That is just the hydrodynamics, which people have talked about for the last few days. And essentially, the equation motion of the hydrodynamic is just the conservation of the stress tensor and the conservation of the conserved current if you have any conserved current, say, if you have any global symmetries. And what you do is that you express the expectation value of your stress tensor or your current in terms of those phenomenological dynamical variables, say, the inverse temperature, the local velocity, and the local chemical potential, which are considered to be the slowly varying function of space-time, and you write those quantities, you write your stress tensor in terms of derivative expansion of those quantities, and then you, now you have a closed equations, which you can solve, And of course, this has been very powerful, and the hydrodynamics has been controlling, we also have seen it for the last few days, and the hydrodynamic control all aspects of our life, and also inside the sun, and also in the galaxy formation of the large-scale structure. And also, during the last decade, we have realized that the hydrodynamics plays a very important role in the description, say, of the quark-gluon plasma, and also in the cold atom systems, and also we have seen in the graphene, okay, and also maybe in some metals. But despite this long and glorious history of hydrodynamics, and this important defect, and it's formulated, hydrodynamics is formulated at the equation of motion, okay, just write down the conservation of the stress tensor and the conservation of the currents. But essentially, by definition, if you only have equation motion, that does not capture fluctuations, you only have equation motion. But equation motion are always there, say inside this room, the density or temperature will fluctuate. There are always statistical fluctuations, there are always thermal fluctuations, etc. There may be also quantum fluctuations. And those fluctuations are important in many different contexts. For example, as recognized in late 70s and early late 60s and early 70s, that these statistical fluctuations can affect your transports, say in the form of this so-called long-time tail. And it also can affect the dynamic aspect of your phase transitions, and also in particular for the non-equilibrium states, and the fluctuations can be particularly important, and also maybe in turbulence. And also we know that if you have a finite size system, say system of small size, like quark-gluon plasma produced in high Vienna conditions, they're typically very small size, small number of particles. And also graphene, they're typically not very big. And so you would expect the statistical fluctuations to be important. And also at low temperatures, there might be also quantum fluctuations one should consider. And of course, the people have developed also at the phenomenological level how to deal with fluctuations. And the standard way is so-called the stochastic hydro. And in addition to your standard classical stress tensor, you add a stochastic piece which can fluctuate. Okay, and the same thing with the currents. And what you do, and those are normally called noises, and then those noises which have a Gaussian distribution, just from the large number theorem, and you assume to have a Gaussian distribution, and importantly, their distribution should satisfy, say, the fluctuation dissipation relations. So let me just elaborate on this point. So suppose, for example, this fluctuation of the stress tensor, T mu mu, and the T lambda rho, and then this should be proportional to your, say, to the delta function, and also proportional to the shear viscosity. So that actually there's no new parameter parameter when you introduce the those fluctuations, and the fluctuations are controlled by your dissipative constant through the standard fluctuation dissipation decision. But this only works well for linear equilibrium situations. For example, if you do a linearized disturbance around the vacuum, then this works perfectly. But once you go beyond the equilibrium situation, so suppose if we have a non-equilibrium situation, then typically the T, yeah, because eta, for example, eta can depend on T and your chemical potential. And now the T will be a function of X. And the mu and T, and they are now also dynamic variables, okay? And it's not obvious then whether this equation still applies. Actually, there may be strong the indications likely this naive generalization may not apply. Anyway, so the story becomes tricky when you go to the non-equilibrium situations.
Sorry, the extent is the spatial position?
Yeah, it's the spatial position, right. Yeah, just in the equilibrium situations, all these are constant, and then this is well defined. But now, when in the non-equilibrium situation, you necessarily depend on background temperature. The temperature may not be uniform, and your chemical potential may not be uniform. And then this equation no longer, it's not obvious it will make sense.
So on the left-hand side is the time average or spatial average?
On the left-hand side is your ensemble average of your fluctuations, yeah. So this is just a lot adequate for far from equilibrium situations. For example, there could be interactions among noises. You may not be able to just use Gaussian always. And also, there will be interactions between dynamical variables and noises. And so this is an example. Such kind of distribution, which is an example of the coupling between the dynamical variables and the noises. And there should be some systematic way to write them down rather than just to postulate them. Okay. And also, the dynamical variable, they should be able to fluctuate themselves. So here, only the noise can fluctuate, but this part cannot fluctuate. But you would expect the dynamic variable should also be able to fluctuate themselves. And to address this question, then boils down to go to the, essentially just you lead to some kind of non-equivalent fluctuation dissipation relation. And even if you are only interested, say the law is at the Gaussian level, and when you go to the far from equivalent situations, and then you have to be able to generalize this expression and to write down some kind of non-equivalent fluctuation dissipation relations. And but until now, I think there's no general principle to tell us how to do those things, okay? You can just postulate, but there's no systematic method to tell us how to do that. And there's one a very old problem is called the Reddy-Ballard problem, which this kind of fluctuation actually plays a very important role. And this problem actually can also be considered as say modeling the situation in this room. So suppose you consider a liquid, and you put some temperature on the top. So you put some air conditioning below air on the top, and then some type some hotter temperature at the bottom. And when the temperature difference between the bottom and the hot bottom and the top is small, and then this system will just have there's no motion, there's no, and then you will just have some kind of static temperature gradient from the bottom, say, to the top, okay? But we all know that if the temperature become big enough, and then there will be convections, okay? And then the fluid will start moving, and then you will have convections. And this transition between this kind of steady state and this convective state is essentially driven by hydrodynamic fluctuations. And in fact, the hydrodynamic fluctuations become infinitely big close to the transition point. And to deal with this kind of situation reliably, you really need, a full treatment, say, of your fluctuations. Okay. And there's another reason why we want to go beyond the current formulation of hydrodynamics, because at the theoretical level, the current formulation is actually rather awkward, even though it works. But at the more fundamental level, it's actually rather awkward. For example, when you write down these constitutive relations, say when you express your stress tensor, say in terms of those dynamic variables, in terms of velocity, temperature, etc., and it's not enough to just write down the most general derivative expansion consistent with symmetries. And if you do that, and then you got the wrong answer, you will get more a transport coefficient, say, than observed in nature. And you actually have to fudge your answer, okay? So naively, what you will do is just write down the most general derivative expansion, but that does not work, and then you have to fudge your answer. And again, Nando tell us how to do it, and essentially you have to put in some phenomenological constraint. And the one important constraint you have to put in is so-called entropy conditions. Is that you have to be able to construct entropy current, again expressed in terms of the dynamic variables, but then the divergence of this current is required to be non-negative, point by point for all space time. Okay, when you evaluate it on your solutions, and then of course this put a strong constraint on your equation motions. And the second thing is that if your underlying system is time reversal symmetric, then there's also something called the Onsager relation. It's that your linear response matrix must be symmetric. And again, this has to be imposed by hand. If you just write down the most general derivative expansion, this is not respected. Okay. So those conditions they work very nicely. They work perfectly. But at the more fundamental level, you would like to understand where does those conditions come from. At least for me personally, this entropy condition is always funny because the normally second law of thermodynamics only tells us for isolated system, the entropy have to increase. But here is a much, much stronger statement. It tells you at each point, you must have entropy current and somehow locally, every point, entropy cannot decrease. Okay. And for myself, I never really understood the reason for this, even though this works very well. And this is also awkward in the sense that one have to use solutions to the properties of the solutions to constrain your equation motion. So it would be nice to have more microscopic understanding of those conditions and also to know whether those conditions are complete. Okay, those are phenomenological constraints, which work very well when you expand your hydrodynamics to first order derivatives. But when you go to higher order derivatives, and it's no longer clear whether those conditions are complete. Okay. And so we will address these issues really by developing hydrodynamics as a generally knowledge effective field theory of a general many body system at finite temperature. And so this will lead to, say, an action principle to full fluctuating hydrodynamics, which are applicable to far from equilibrium situations. Okay. So I emphasize that this should be distinguished, from just write down an action, from writing an action which just reproduces the equation motion. Because if you just write down an action which just reproduces the equation motion, it may not be guaranteed that this captures the fluctuations correctly. And in order to do that, you really need some general principle to tell you what should be the right dynamical variable or what should be the symmetries. Of course, the searching for action principle for dissipative hydrodynamics has been a, say, long-standing problem, even dating back to Hack laws in 1911. He already tried to write down an action for the ideal fluids, and there are many subsequent work in over the years. And and also the Sergey and Alberto friends, they revived the subject during the last decade. Also, there are lots of interests motivated by their work, including myself, etc. And also, I should mention there's a closely related work to ours by Hale, Loglagan, and Ragamani, which there are many similar features. But also there are many important differences. So right now, I don't know whether these two formalisms are equivalent or not. OK, so let's first talk about dissipation. If you want to include a dissipation, the standard norm is that the dissipative system don't really have an action formulation. So this is the most familiar example, which you know from high school, is that if you have a friction, and then we don't know how to write down a Lagrangian or action for equation motion with friction, okay? But it's a little bit ironic. Somehow the best way to solve this problem, even though this is a classical problem, this is your high school problem, and the ironic to solve this problem, the most natural way is actually by going to quantum mechanics. And in quantum mechanics, this problem actually can be naturally solved as follows. So if you're interested in this kind of dynamics, and this is, you are interested in the real-time dynamics around the state. Yeah, because we are interested in the physics around the state, not the transition amplitude, as normally you do in particle physics. As normally in particle physics, if you are interested in transition amplitude, then you have initial state, you have a final state, then that's how you do your path integral. Okay, you go from t equal to minus infinity, you go to t plus infinity. But now if you are interested in the expectation value inside the state, say for general density matrix, you can also be a pure state. And now you actually have to not only go to infinity, and now you have to come back. And then you corresponding to sandwich among the same states, okay? And now it means you actually have to do a double quantum. You have to, your space-time path integral have to go from t equal to minus infinity to t plus infinity, and then go back to t minus infinity, okay? And then you are able to do the expectation value for around the state, another transition amplitude. And so this is normally called the closed time path or Schwinger-Kadish quantum. And so you can also, instead of thinking of this, the doubled quantum, you can also think about a single space time, but now you have two sets of fields, okay, which live on each leg of this quantum. And so a lot of way to think about it is just you have to double your number of degrees of freedom. You have a single space time, but you need to double your number of degrees of freedom. And once you do this in quantum mechanics, and then you can just now apply this to this simple a particle problem, single particle problem, and now you double your degrees of freedom, so x1 and x2. And now you can couple it to a certain bath, say in the thermal state, and then you just integrate out the bus. Okay, if you do that, then you will find something like this. Then you find if when you integrate out the bus, then the effective action for this degree of freedom will be like this, say when you write it in terms of derivative expansion. And then this x will be the average of the two. This xa will be the difference between the two. Okay? And now if you find the equation motion for the x, then I forgot the dot here. And then you precisely have this kind of friction equation motion. Okay? And so for the average of them, you precisely have the friction. And then with a stochastic force, and this stochastic force is the Legendre transform, say, of this the difference between them. Okay? And then this static force, again, will satisfy some kind of Gaussian distribution, whose distribution will be related to your friction. And again, some fluctuation dissipation relation.
Oh, sure.
Yes?
There's some extra boundary conditions you have to impose relating x1 to x2 to infinity.
So at infinity, they have to be the same. So here, they have to be smoothly connected. Yeah.
Lagrangian is imaginary?
Yeah, the Lagrangian is in general complex.
How does that happen?
Oh, that's precisely what you want. Because now imagine you multiply this L by I, and then this just becomes a Gaussian fluctuation of your Lois.
But it started presumably it's real to begin with.
And yeah.
You integrate out the bath.
Yeah, you have to integrate out the bath. Yeah, you integrate out all these gapless but short-lived degrees of freedom, and that can generate this kind of complex thing. Yeah. Anyway, so the difference between them now just become the noise, and in particular, at this quadratic level, the Legendre conjugate then become your stochastic force and etc. And the interesting thing is that even though this is a quantum mechanical, but if you take the classical limit, and then this noise actually survives, and then this just corresponding to the statistical fluctuations, and for this particle coupled to a bus, okay, and So that's the strategy we are going to deal with to write down effective action for the hydrodynamics. Is that say for a strongly coupled theory, say let's imagine, say your cutoff is ordered the temperature, and then we try to write down a low energy effective theory for those gapless degrees of freedom, which are now the degrees of freedom which are associated with conserved quantities, okay? And then we try to write down effective action for that. And then starting from here, you have to consider the starboard contour, and then you have essentially have two sets of hydrodynamic modes. You have two sets of hydrodynamic modes, and now then you can do the RG, and then you can just for the macroscopic phenomena you can just do the standard RG, starting from this effective action. So this is the effective action as defined at some UV scale, and if you want to go to infrared physics, then you do your standard story. And so two things to emphasize. Is that once you do this, integrate out all these other degrees of freedom, and then the thermal state is already gone. Okay, even your UV definition is in the thermal density matrix, but once you go to this effective field theory, and your thermal state is already gone, and the thermal state is just reflected in the coefficient of your action. Okay, and so the coefficient of your effective action should reflect that this comes from a thermal state. And the secondly is that the standard hydrodynamics then would just correspond to the saddle point equations. Okay, you just do the equation motion, and then you should recover your standard hydro. So this is the necessary condition such an effective theory should satisfy. But now to write down such an effective theory, and then we have to ask the question, first, what are the dynamical variables? Okay? So you can convince yourself that actually the standard phenomenological variables don't work. And you can just do this by trial and error yourself. But there's also a philosophical way to think about it, is that if you look at the equation motion for those variables, say for example at the ideal fluid level, you find first order equations. And you know that for the first order equations, it's often hard to write down an action. And just like in E&M, the equation motion for the electric and the magnetic fields are first order. But in order to write down an action, you actually have to go to the potential. Okay? So here, similarly, and in order to write down some kind of action, you have to go to something more fundamental. And then we have to understand what are the symmetries. Okay? And then lastly, if you're really interested in the full problem, you also need to worry about what should be the precise integration measure here. Okay, these two, in principle, already can write down action for you. So here, for conceptual simplicity, I will just describe the story for neutral fluids, but it's easy to write down for full charge fluids. And this can also be generalized to superfluids. So now let's talk about what should be the dynamical variables. So now let's, first I will tell you the answer, and then I will give you the argument how we get the answer. So first, let's recall the so-called Lagrange description of hydrodynamics, okay? So the Lagrange description of the hydrodynamics is that you use a label sigma I. So you can see you have a continuum of the fluids. And then you associate each fluid element, you associate a label. Okay, you associate a label. And we call sigma I. And then the motion of a fluid then can be just described by a mapping of this label space to your physical space. Okay? And of course, this depends on time. So suppose you fix sigma I, you fix a particular fluid element, and then this function as a function of t, it just describes the motion of this particular fluid element in the space-time, and then that describes your fluid motion, okay? And then if you change sigma I, then of course you describe all fluid elements. So we actually developed an integrated-in procedure to identify gapless and non-lived experiments associated with a conserved stress tensor. And the answer turned out to be very simple. It turned out that the answer, the proper quantum field theory way to think about it, turned out to give you the answer, which is just the doubled version of this Lagrangian picture, say, 300 years ago. And because now we have double your space-time, and now you have two copies of your space-time, so now you have two of them. And another slight generalization is that in addition to the physical space-time, associated with each fluid element, now we associate an intrinsic internal time with each fluid element. And then this mapping would be a fluid element space-time that mapped to the physical space-time, okay? So this would be the picture. And so you have fluid space-time, which is the enabling space, and then you have physical space-time, now you have two copies. And again, if you fix sigma I, and just change sigma zero, and this function, these two functions just map to the trajectory of this particular fluid element in the space-time, okay? So now let me tell you a little bit. Also, this is a picture very natural from the holographic point of view. So now let me just tell you how we reached this conclusion. And so for this purpose, let me just first look at the simple example. Just look at the single conserved current, okay? So our idea is that we want to extract that particular, the gapless modes associated with this conserved quantity, okay? So for this purpose, let's just write down the generating functional corresponding to this current. Okay, again, you have to use this closed time path. So you have two copies of the current, okay? For each part of the contour, you have a source. You have a source, A1 and A2, and for each part of the contour, you have a current. Okay, so this is generating functional when you take a derivative over A, and then you get correlation functions of J's. And of course, this is your full generating functional. You have to integrate out everything, okay? So because of this current is conserved, and then you can easily convince yourself that this generating function is invariant under the gauge transformation of this source, okay? And if you shift by a total derivative, and then because of the conservation of J, and then this should be invariant. And the second point is that because we have integrated out all modes, then this W must be non-local. And the non-locality must solely due to we integrate out the hydrogen modes. because the atom mode is only a long-lived and a gapless degree freedom here, okay? So our goal now is try to integrate in those dynamical variables, such kind of hydrogen modes, okay? So normally in quantum field theory, if you have a gapless system, to integrate in is something impossible because you have lots of freedom. But here it's actually about the constrained system because we have conservation, okay? So here I claim it's possible. So we like to integrate in the hydrogen modes, okay? Just motivated from these two points, try to find what should be the gapless mode associated with this conserved current. And the way to do this is following. So I claim, say, suppose you have some modes, okay? Suppose you have successfully found this mode, okay? Then you should be able to write your path integral, your full generating functional in terms of path integral of this gapless mode, this hydrogen mode associated with this current. And now this action, they must be local, because this is the only source of non-locality, okay? And so now this action must be local. So that means now this action must be local. And another is that this action must be such that this current conservation is satisfied, that this generating function after you do the path integral should be invariant under this gate transformation, okay? And so this is the second condition. And the third condition is associated that the phi are the gapless mode associated with this current conservation. So that must be that the phi equation motion must be equivalent to the current conservation, because we know the current conservation is the equation motion for the hydrodynamics, okay? And the phi equation motion must be equivalent to the current conservation. So now I claim with these three conditions, we can actually fix this phi, okay, which I can fix phi, and I will just tell you the answer. And the proposal is that the phi must be just the Starkberg field for this external source. So essentially, you just require your action to be a function of this B, and this B must have the form that is the following combination of your external source and your dynamic field, and this phi is your dynamic field. You have two copies of them. And then this is a local action, okay? And so this is a claim. And then you can easily check that this satisfies all the conditions. First, essentially, but just by definition, because this phi corresponding to the longitudinal part of A, when you integrate out the phi, then of course A, the generating function is automatically satisfied this, okay? And the second, and you can also check that because of this particular combination, and the phi are equivalent to the current conservation, okay? And so that justifies that your action, your dependence on your dynamic variable must come in this particular combination, okay? Yes?
So here you're assuming there's no additional massless mode?
Yeah, that's right. So we consider generic situation. If you are near the phase transition, if you have additional ghost mode, et cetera, then you have to put additional modes in.
When you say IFB1 and V2 is a local action, do you mean to say that it's the most general local action in a derivative expansion consistent
yeah.
with the symmetries as long as you just use V1 and V2?
Exactly. Yeah, but later we will impose symmetries. I have not talked about symmetries, but later we will impose symmetries. And now you can do the similar thing with the stress tensor. So now for the stress tensor, you just put your space-time in different metric, turn on external metric, okay? And you have two lags, and then you just put the space, a different space match, space-time metric associated with each lag. And so you can just do the same thing, and again, because of the current conservation, because of conservation of the stress tensor, and now your generating functional should be diffeomorphism invariant. When you make a diffeomorphism of your space-time, and then your generating functional should be diffeomorphism invariant. And so when you make a diffeomorphism, this should be invariant. But now we know, from this current example, we know what to do, how to do the integration in these hydrogen modes. Essentially, we just promote your space-time coordinates. Essentially, just promote this diffeomorphism variable in terms of the dynamic fields, okay? And then when you integrate out those, when you integrate over those the field, then you will automatically satisfy this diffeomorphism invariant condition. So just generalize this current case, and now we can write the generating function of G in terms of integrating out of this X, and the X essentially is a diffeomorphism mapping. It's a diffeomorphism acting on your space-time metric, okay? And so you assume this additional X, so you promote your space-time coordinate to some dynamic field of some other variables, and then you perform this diffeomorphism, and then you require your action must be a local action of this combination, okay, of this combination. And and then again, when you integrate out this X, so that will guarantee your action is diffeomorphism, your generating function is diffeomorphism invariant, and will also ensure, and also this particular combination you can check that ensures that the X equation motion are equivalent to the conservation of the stress tensor. Okay, so here, this is something surprising happening. In order to do the stress tensor, we actually have to introduce an emergent space-time, okay, because of this sigma, this X. So if you want to promote your space-time coordinate into a dynamic variable, then this have to be something function of something else. So we have to introduce some additional variables.
So this looks so general, then one wonders, why can't you apply the same logic to any system? Like, I don't know, a standard model in its vacuum, where are the X's there? For sure, we don't have those modes in that case. So, but still, the stress energy tensor is conserved. If I couple to an external metric, the generating function is different variant.
Right, but this is the assumption that the gapless modes, the only gapless modes are those associated with the conserved quantities. If you have a stress tensor, you will have some other gapless modes. But if you put the standard mode at finite temperature, and then all the other modes are gapped out, then the only gapless modes are these quantities.
So let's say I take a system in which a Lorentz invariant system is in a Lorentz invariant vacuum without any gapless modes, like all the particles are massive.
Okay.
I don't have the X's there, but according to this logic, I should have them around. So where does this logic fail there?
Yeah, so the assumption is that there must be, so the input is that this system must have gapless modes associated with the conserved quantity. If you just have a purely gapped system, then that system just don't have any gapped modes, or just don't have any gapless modes, even associated with the stress tensor, And so there you can just write down a local expansion of your external metric. You don't have to introduce this thing. Yeah, there you can just straightforwardly write, there you can just do a local expansion of this W.
Oh, great. Even gap system at finite temperature have
depend on your temperature.
Yeah.
Wow. It depends on temperature. I'm just saying, suppose if you have a gap system at zero temperature, and then you can just do a local expansion of this. Okay, so also I want, also here we need to introduce something else. We need to introduce by hand a local temperature, okay? Introduce additional scalar field which will correspond to the local temperature. And so these are the degrees of freedom of your theory, okay? So this X and tau's. And so as I just said, this X, and now we can just interpret in the Lagrangian point of view, this sigma. So in order to do this diffeomorphism, we have to treat X as some function of the sigma, and then we just interpret the sigma as Lagrangian point of view, as label each fluid element, and sigma zero, and time component corresponding to internal time, okay? And then this is the thing I described before, and so we just recovered a double copy of the Lagrangian description of the fluid. And so as a starting point, we could just simply double the number of degrees of freedom in the Lagrangian description. In hindsight, but this I claim would be a field theoretical way to derive the result. Okay, so with this picture, and now you can construct the standard hydro variables in the straightforward way. For example, the standard velocity field, you can just take the derivative, take the average of these two x. So this X corresponding to the space-time coordinate, just as the case of this single particle case, you can just take the average of X, and then take derivative with your internal time, and then this develops a velocity, and then you choose a normalization factor so that this u squared equal to minus one, and then you we also interpret this tau, say, as the temperature, and as the local temperature. And then, again, the difference between the, them will be interpreted as noise. Okay, we interpret as noise. So now we have a significant challenge. Because the, so far what I said is no different from a liquid and a solid. Okay, in the solid, there's also Lagrangian description. And you can also do the same thing. The same thing applies. But there's a big difference between the solid and the, and the liquid. In the solid, these are just fundamental variables, okay? And they will appear in your equation motions. And in the equation motions, these are this x are essentially deviations from your equilibrium, and then of course you will have harmonic force which depends on the deviations, etc. But for the liquid, since things can move around freely, and in the liquid, your equation motion cannot depend on those x directly, cannot depend on locations directly. So they can only express in terms of the velocity, okay, because we have to reconstruct the standard hydrodynamic equations, and for liquid, and you have to make sure your actions are such that they, the equation motion can solely be expressed in terms of velocities, not those fundamental variables, okay? And this requires we put in additional symmetries into the system. So let me just remind you again that the sigma I labeled the fluid element, and sigma zero is the internal time. But now this is, but now with this interpretation, there's a very simple way to think of, about what kind of symmetry you should impose, okay? And you remember the symmetry, the theory is defined in this fluid space-time, okay? The symmetry is, the theory is defined in this, the, in this fluid space-time because we are using Lagrangian point of view. And now we want to impose the symmetries to this action so that this describes a liquid, okay? So how do we do that? And this is easy to do. First, since the liquid can move everywhere, so we require at a single time slice, okay, at a single time slice, that you should have the freedom to completely relabel your fluid element, okay? So that corresponding to a pure spatial diffeomorphism, okay? And your physics should not depend on that, okay? Your physics should not depend on that. You can arbitrarily relabel your fluid element at a single time, and that should not change your physics. But you cannot make this to depend on time, because you depend on time, and then you also include the fluid motion into the relabeling, so you cannot make it depend on time, okay? Because when the fluid starts moving, and then the label should be fixed. The label should be fixed. And now, if you focus on the individual fluid element, and the individual fluid element, they should be able to have time reparameterization symmetry associated with that fluid element. And in particular, since in the liquid, different fluid elements, they don't correlate with each other, and you should be able to have this time reparameterization which are independently for each fluid element, okay? So that means you should be able to have a time reparameterization which are depend on each individual fluid element, okay? And then that's it. Then I claim this, these two symmetries are what characterize a liquid, okay? Are what characterize a liquid. And now you can do a consistency check, and indeed it turns out this symmetry does do magic for you, okay? And you find at the level equation motion, and they ensure all the dependence on the dynamic variable can indeed be just expressed in terms of velocity, not in terms of the, those x variables. Okay, and yes?
Yeah, so in our way of doing things, we were insisting that this parameterization of the fluid element labels, they need to be volume preserving.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
a big difference between moving things around and
That's
compressing
right.
them.
Yeah,
Whereas
yeah.
here, in your way of doing things, it seems that you don't need that requirement.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
It's because these are just labels. And the non-trivial physics is encoded in this mapping.
But then you could say the same words for solid, no? Because if you insist that this is nothing but changing name to things.
No, no, for solid you cannot, because this label each fluid element. And for solid, you have much less symmetry.
You have less symmetry, but I'm saying if you give up, if you don't see here the need not to compress the fluid,
right.
why should you see the need not to strain the solid in the transverse direction? They are physically.
I'm just saying the volume preserving is reflected in here, not reflected in here. It's encoded in this mapping, and that encodes this. Yeah. Yeah. This is like some kind of internal space without the metric.
But for fluid, for solid, what would be the
solution? So for the solid, I have not thought it very carefully. I thought a little bit. I think you have to relax them much more. You have much less symmetry. You have much less symmetry, and I don't think you actually should impose this one. Yeah. Anyway, so this already recovers the standard formulation of hydrodynamics, modulo those from logical constraints. Okay. And so now you essentially have reduced the problem of finding a nonlinear fluid fluctuating dynamics to some a differential geometry problem. So you write down action to be invariant under the spatial diffeomorphism and the time reparaturization, okay? And then you can write down the covariant derivatives which respect to those symmetries, and then now you actually see you have two rich tensors. Do you also have, say, a torsion? And all these things will map into, when you translate into the physical space-time variables, and then that corresponding to, say, various hydrodynamic tensors. For example, this torsion just map to the vorticity and the exaction, okay? And this will be the full story in the usual situation. This will be the full story in the usual situation, but now we have a somewhat different situation. Because we are considering a system defined on this closed time path, okay? Just being defined on this closed time path actually puts some additional global constraint on your correlation functions. And then the correlation functions, so if your effective field theory should be consistent, they should respect those global constraints imposed by this contour, okay? So that means that your effective field theory should have additional symmetries. Your effective theory should have additional symmetries so that those global constraints are satisfied after you do the path integral, okay? So there are actually three of them. So the first is what we call by reflectivity condition. So essentially, if you take the complex conjugate of your generating functional, and essentially just you just revert the direction of the contour, then you just exchange the g1, g2. Say suppose g1 associated with this neck and g2 associated with this neck. When you take a complex conjugate, then you just revert the direction, and then you just exchange g1, g2. Okay, and so this condition should be satisfied, and then this can be easily required. By requiring the action satisfy some kind of D2 reflection symmetry. And turns out this D2 reflection symmetry have the following form, and because of this star, actually requires that your action is actually complex. In particular, not only the action is complex, and the even powers of the Lois field are required to be pure imaginary, okay? You can just work out this the consequence of this action. And if you have part of the action is pure imaginary, then you have to impose additional condition. It says the imaginary part must be non-negative, okay, for arbitrary off-shell configuration, because otherwise your path integral is not well defined. So you will require the action as such that the imaginary part is non-negative.
Does it also follow from some sort of optical theorem?
I don't know how to.
Imaginary part comes from integrating out this path. When the path is on shell, you get an imaginary part.
Yeah. I don't know how to prove that from the first principle. I'm just saying, if you want to make sense of this path integral at effective field theory level, that's a constraint you must impose. And indeed, it would be interesting to see whether one can prove it from first principle. Yes.
Just to check that understanding. If your sources are complex, you have to complex conjugate on the right hand side.
Yeah, but we do the real source. Yeah, we always consider real source. Yeah. Okay, but another condition is so called the Kermesse condition. is that the correlation functions of some state must satisfy additional set of constraints. So this is so-called Kubo-Martin-Stringer conditions. So at the two-point function level, if you have two operators, and then these have the following form, you essentially exchange the order of B and A, and then you shift one of them, say, by I beta, in the imaginary time direction by inverse temperature, okay? And then you can also write down the general such condition for all point functions, for any point functions. So conversely, the KMS condition can be used to characterize the thermal state. So if you require all your correlation function to satisfy KMS condition, then we can say, indeed, we are describing an effective field theory in the thermal state. Okay, so this KMS condition is crucial. And now, you can combine this KMS condition plus CPT, and then that turns out to imply a Z2 symmetry on your generating functional, okay? So your generating functional should satisfy the following condition. So immersion of X is related to your CPT, and then from the KMS, and then you have a shift of minus I beta 0 for one of the sources. And this beta 0 it should be considered as the inverse temperature at the spatial infinity when you have a non-equilibrium situations. Okay? And so this is a KMS condition you need to satisfy, but I will not go into detail here. Then with some effort, you find that this condition can be satisfied at the tree level of path integral by imposing a Z2 symmetry on the action, okay? Which we call the local KMS condition. I will not write down the condition here. And let me just tell you the consequence of this condition. So the bottom line is that to satisfy this condition, we need to impose some Z2 symmetry on your action, okay? And turns out when you impose this Z2 symmetry, again, that does magic for you. And then you find that Z2 symmetry ensures that all the constraints from the entropy current condition and the linear unsaturated relation are satisfied by equation motion, okay? They all just follow from this Z2 symmetry. And now you don't have to impose them phenomenologically, and there's a Z2 symmetry which ensures all of them. And in addition, you find additional constraints. And you find additional constraint. This additional constraint can be considered as some consequence of some nonlinear generalization of the unsaturated relations. Because unsaturated relation normally is formulated in the linear response. But there's actually a nonlinear version of it. It turns out at the first derivative level, if you expand to first derivative order, the linear constraint already implies all the nonlinear constraints. But when you go to higher derivative order, this is no longer true, and the linear constraint no longer imply all the nonlinear constraints, so you can have actually new constraints on your from the nonlinear unsaturated relations. Okay, so this just also you actually derive some non-equilibrium fluctuation dissipation relations. So from now you have recovered all the all your hydrodynamics. But actually, there's something more you can do, which we just recently realized recently. Is that by combining this local Z2 KMS condition, and this actually, it turns out that this Z2 symmetry, so normally Z2 symmetry does not give you anything like a current, okay? But turns out in this case, Paolo Glorioso, he has a very nice observation. Turns out in this case, this particular Z2 symmetry actually can give rise to a current. But since this is a Z2 symmetry, and this current is actually not conserved, okay? And now, but you have a current, but now if you combine with the equation motion under the non-lactivity of the imaginary part of the action, then you find the divergence of this current actually precisely equal to the precisely equal to the non-negative form for the imaginary part of the action, and then it's non-negative, okay? And then we have actually derived. So this is like the Boltzmann's H theorem restricted to the hydrodynamic limit. And so we have derived that you actually always exists to all derivative order a conserved entropy current which is non-negative. And you can actually construct this order by order this just from this Northrop procedure, from this Z2 symmetry. And now when you go to ideal fluid level, and then you find that the ideal fluid level, just due to some accidental symmetry, and then this S mu is actually conserved, and then coincide with the standard entropy current, okay? coincide with the standard entropy current.
So how do you apply the network procedure to discrete symmetry?
Yeah, the key is that this this particular Z2 symmetry does not give you the Lagrangian equal to the Lagrangian. Okay. It's equal to Lagrangian plus total derivatives. And then that give you, and then the total derivative part then can be now give rise something like loss currents. But because this is only Z2, you don't have a continuous parameter, then this is not conserved. But then turned out the structure of the equation are precise that the right-hand side is equal to, is given by this imaginary part of your action. Yeah.
If this inequality is saturated, does that mean there's an emergent U1? Does Z2 get enhanced?
Yeah, yeah. So if this equality is saturated, that means certain dissipative coefficient is zero. For example, shear viscosity. If shear viscosity is zero, a bulk viscosity is zero, then this will be saturated. And so those dissipative terms will be, yeah.
I hear you say it satisfies at tree level. Can you argue that it's not spontaneously broken at higher order?
Yeah, yeah. That's the thing I'm going to. So to relate to the standard hydrodynamics, you only need to worry about the tree level because that's the because the standard hydrodynamic is the equation motion. Uh-huh. And certainly, we expect when you include the fluctuations, then the entropy will not satisfy this condition. Uh-huh. And this is only a classical, a semi-classical. It's really a set of point statement. Yeah. Okay. I'm close to running out of time. So let me just say one more thing. So there's another simple condition, which is called unitarity condition. He said if you put this two space-time metric for this two lag to be the same. Then the evolution operator to going from here to there and come back will be the same operator. And then when you take the trace, and then you just take them together, and then you just get trace rho zero just equal to one. So that means when you take these two metrics together, and then you, this should be zero, okay? The generating function to be zero. So in some sense, this can be considered as a condition on the path integral measure, okay? Because somehow your path integral have to satisfy this condition. And so there's a known story, also there's many work in the past in the stochastic system, et cetera. But let me just tell you, there's actually a very simple resolution. You actually need to introduce some kind of fermionic partner for each dynamical variable, and then to require the action to have some BIST type of symmetry as a delta square equal to zero. And then with this, and you find that this condition can be satisfied at the full quantum level. Just the fermion we always cancel with the boson determinant, etc. Okay. And the surprising thing is that the fermionic field actually survives in the classical limit because here we consider when you talk about unitarity, we consider quantum mechanics, etc. But you can also take the classical limit by taking h bar goes to zero. But the interesting thing is that when you take h bar goes to zero, you find the path integral does not decouple. The path integral is still there because we know it must be there because the path integral should also capture the statistical fluctuations. Okay, so when you take h bar equal to zero, you find actually path integral still survives, and also those fermionic field actually also survives in the classical limit. So we reach a rather interesting conclusion is that even to describe classical statistical fluctuations properly, you actually need to introduce some kind of anti-commuting object. Somehow this is like classical remnant of the quantum conditions, okay? You have to introduce some fermions. Also, I emphasize that here the BIST symmetry is actually a global symmetry. You don't impose that the operator to be BIST invariant, etc.
So you're saying there's no way to write down a measure with just those fields that you introduce at the beginning that obeys that?
No. Yeah, you can easily do it at one loop. And you can see that it's not satisfied. And then the simplest way to do it is to introduce these fermions to cancel this one loop. And then if you want to go beyond the one loop, then the BIST will do the job for you, for all loops. Okay, so now, then there's another surprise. It turns out, so we find a strong indication of it, we don't have the full story, that this BIST plus this local KMS condition, if you combine them together, then there's another emergent fermionic symmetry, and now you have additional fermionic symmetry we call delta bar. And now you have two fermionic symmetry, say in the classical limit, And then now you have two Feynman symmetry, delta square equal to zero, delta y equal to zero. And then the commutator of these two, so this should be anti-commutator. Yeah, it doesn't matter. You can imagine the variation parameters already inside. So the commutator of these two variations actually give you precise the time translation. So this is just like the standard supersymmetry in the time direction, okay? So so such symmetry, supersymmetry has also been postulated in this paper. And but the full content of those symmetry, emergence of the symmetry is not fully understood. And with Ping Gao, we are finding some progress in understanding them. And also interestingly, if you now take a finite H bar, and now turns out there's a quantum deformed Suzy algebra. Something like this, okay? And with now this this partial t replaced by tanh. This is very easy to understand because this tanh appears in the fluctuation dissipation relation, and so that's the reason why it appears. Anyway, just to summarize, so in order to describe the hydrodynamics with classical statistical fluctuations, it's actually described by a supersymmetric quantum field theory. And if you want to ask what is the effective H bar of this system, essentially this is the standard story. It's essentially just 1 over S, okay? And this recovers the standard hydrodynamics, all the old constraints, and you also find new constraints, and also find the non-equivalent fluctuation dissipation relations, etc. And but with the hydrodynamics quantum fluctuation incorporated, and then somehow now you have some kind of quantum deformed algebra, which I don't fully understand it yet, okay? So let me just show you the bosonic action for the charged fluid. And so this is the this is part corresponding to the response, and then this is part corresponding to the noise, etc. And anyway, so hopefully those action can help us to learn some new physics. For example, in this Rayleigh-Ballard problem, maybe now we can really properly describe this phase transition, this non-equivalent phase transition, say from a steady state to a convective state. And so there are many future directions. Okay, yes, I will stop here, thanks.
Questions? My name is Nang, very well, like you have this connection, fluid gravity connection between classical equations of hydrodynamics and the classical equations of gravity. So do you think with this it could be possible to elevate that to an action principle and like have quantum equivalence between the two sides in some sense?
Yeah, I think that should be possible. Actually, we spend a lot of effort doing that, but that requires some completely different ways to do it. And we have made some progress, but have not solved the full problems yet. Yeah, actually, we started doing that, doing the holographic side. We thought that would be easier. You just take the Einstein action. Yeah. Maybe you can write down the hydro action. But it turned out the story is more complicated. And then in the process of doing that, we find that one can actually write down the most general field theory.
Thank our speaker again.
Yep.